16 to 1, a podcast about education, teaching, and learning.
Hi.
How's it going?
You have a lot of water in front of you.
I have a giant jug of water. I'm hydrating prior to my vaccine appointment.
The day this comes out.
Yeah, the day this
You're
comes out.
Poked.
Like when this comes out, I will be in transit to my vaccine appointment. I'm excited.
It's big news.
It is big news. Life is starting to return to a little bit of normal-ish.
I feel like we're getting tricked a little bit. I think the weather is doing that.
Yeah.
But it's a good feeling.
Yeah, I've heard people start to worry about a third wave of COVID, so I'm not sure.
Is this only the third wave?
I guess maybe we're on like the 33rd wave.
I'm just kidding.
The 300th
I think
wave.
The weather is doing this. I think that's what's happening. I think we're falling into the prey of, oh, it's nice. And
yeah,
I must be outside with a drink in my hand.
Yeah, I saw some tweet from somebody who lives and works in England. And they were like, people are out here swimming in the channel and it's like near freezing water, but they're still doing it because there's like a single ray of sunshine
there's
out.
A chance.
And the people of Great Britain just lose their minds when the sun comes back out. So
I mean, I did talk to my parents yesterday about opening their pool. So
yeah.
We're not quite there yet, but I was like, maybe just put it on the books.
I mean, so tis we're ready. The season.
Yeah.
Tis the season.
Yeah. So that's a good feeling.
Yeah.
And you're getting the poke and
getting
that's
poke.
All good news.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Started the 4th 9 weeks.
Ooh.
Didn't think we'd ever
Endgame.
Get here. Yeah. Didn't know it ever happened.
The last grading period.
Can't believe I've been teaching in person during a pandemic for almost a whole year.
You sure have been.
But here we are.
Here we are.
I love the 4th 9 weeks for like a million reasons, but it's my favorite. So it's a good feeling.
Good.
Yeah.
I'm glad.
Except for grades are due tomorrow. So
we'll just pretend like that's not happening. All right. Well, what are we talking about this week?
We are talking about teacher evaluations.
Yes, we are.
Which now I'm mad.
We're talking about evaluating.
It happens
you.
So fast.
Congratulations. You are being evaluated.
I'm not interested.
Every minute of every day.
Oh, God, I know.
A microscope on you.
America's teachers.
Ew.
That's the worst commercial I've ever heard. I hate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I do have some problems with teacher evaluations, which we'll get into, I'm sure.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a little complicated as a practice.
Yes.
And I want to also say that my dad was a teacher for 30 years, and I think he said he was evaluated in person like 3 times in 30 years.
Wow.
You're which makes me wonder what
like
administrators did back then.
Yeah.
What were they
yeah.
doing?
Yeah, I mean, well, same question, honestly, I could apply to today's administrators, but that's neither here nor
well,
there.
Well, they're evaluating us.
They are.
Constantly.
They are.
I'm just, those are the things I think about, and I hear him talk about never being evaluated, and I wish that was my life, so.
Well, okay, so we're going to kind of...
I tap out, I leave.
Yeah.
I got mad.
Good night, goodbye.
Did all this research. I brought data to this one.
Oh, you brought data.
Why? I brought value added.
That's
I brought.
True.
I have all kinds of stuff.
You did bring data. Okay.
I did my homework.
We're going to back into this because we can't really ignore the national backdrop against which these conversations take place because there's this whole legacy of crap from No Child Left Behind, which then later evolved into the Every Student Succeeds Act.
ESSA.
Yeah, ESSA. So let's just, because this is in terms of what things are for teacher evaluations right now in this country,
yep.
all of this stuff is really important to talk about and to understand.
Not really.
Well, it's important to understand because we went through this huge, big NCLB, No Child Left Behind, was this monumental attempt to reform education in this country. And what it kind of did was like, it introduced a lot of federal oversight to schools, supposedly.
Yeah.
It was this attempt to standardize the experience that students get in terms of, oh, well,
a national education.
Yeah, a national education system so that we don't have...
Which maybe isn't wrong.
It's an interesting attempt, for sure. It's
like, I don't think that I would disagree with the fact that we should hope as a nation that our educations are consistent.
Yeah, so that was the idea.
Like, I think I can get there.
The idea, the problem that this was trying to solve was that people in different places in the country get different qualities of education. Now, there's, you know, there are all kinds of differences between
I have bad news for you.
Rural and urban schools.
That's,
you know,
so true.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Did I ruin the episode?
Yeah, a little
early
bit.
Early on? Okay.
You ruined it a little bit.
I'm sorry. Let's start over.
Okay. Yeah. So there are all of these differences. A lot of them have to do with income distribution or racial breakdowns or, you know, just like students at or above poverty lines. It's a whole big mess. But the issue is there are varying degrees of quality for teachers, basically, in school districts across the country. So NCLB was an attempt to provide a framework for standardizing at least the quality of the education that students receive. Among other parts of NCLB, there are all these like standards, and we've kind of talked about that a little bit before. When we talked about Common Core, we talked about the standards that came out of NCLB, but then mm-hmm. there's this other part that was a really big part of No Child Left Behind, and that's this kind of attempt at a prescription for teacher evaluations on a national scale. We link those academic standards that I was just mentioning to student outcomes in these states, and then you as teachers are measured on how well your students are progressing year over year. Are they making progress? Adequate yearly progress is the term that was used. AYP, adequate yearly progress. Progress or performance. Yeah, progress, I think. They're supposed to make progress every single year, students. So
this is a big problem.
Oh, is it? You don't say.
I just had a moment where it all clicked and I got really
mad. You're
just
getting like struck in the head by a 2x4 of NCLB. Yeah,
it's just happening slowly. Mm-hmm. Well, because I was thinking about where you're about to go, which is the highly qualified teacher stuff, which we have to sign every year on a form that says that we are that. Mm-hmm. But AYP is a problem, especially for younger grades. And I guess, everyone. Actually, it's a problem for everyone now that I say it out loud, but it's assuming that every single year you can make at least X amount of growth. And there are obviously years and just brain functioning where you are going to learn way more or maybe not. You know, like those are the things it doesn't account for.
Talking about sort of like child psychology, like development.
Yes, like
the developmentally
of the brain. Speaking, mm-hmm. there are times in a child's life where that just isn't always there.
Or it doesn't look the same year over year or whatever. But anyway, NCLB tries to say, no. It's you're right to point that out. But NCLB tries to say, okay, there should be some progress every year for everyone mm-hmm. of some sort. Mm. And in evaluating teachers, NCLB kind of lumps people together into
a big old pile of differentiated learning.
Yeah. Well, it also lumps teachers together into groups of highly qualified or not highly qualified, and schools have to report to parents all kinds of data. Yeah, they have to report to parents all kinds of data about whether they're being taught by a teacher or a paraprofessional who doesn't meet highly qualified requirements. And the highly qualified requirements are like, you know, a certain number of postgraduate continuing education mm-hmm. hours, like a master's degree or whatever.
Yeah,
it is,
what your bachelor's is in.
Yeah.
How you earned, all mm-hmm. of those things.
So, like, all kinds of stuff, and then ongoing teacher evaluations factor into that, as do professional development hours and all kinds of other things.
Highly qualified can also be difficult because some people come to teaching after another degree.
Yes.
So they run into that a lot of times where they might have the degree, but they're not highly qualified for it.
Jeez. Yeah. The terminology,
I'm not sure I'm qualified for it, to be quite frank with you.
The terminology is very frustrating for a lot of teachers, and it's just a huge mess. Well, anyway, so here's more on the highly qualified stuff. Prior to NCLB, new teachers typically were required to have a bachelor's degree, is what you were just talking about, to be fully certified, and they had to demonstrate subject matter and knowledge. So, like, having a degree in math or something, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But now you've got to have education-related coursework. Also,
this is the old praxis.
Right. So we've got this concept that teaching has two components. It's the subject matter knowledge and mm-hmm. teaching, pedagogical knowledge. So like knowing how to teach is a separate thing in the mind of NCLB from
teaching,
knowing
the thing
the subject,
that you are qualified to teach.
Which abstractly, I totally understand that, because there are some people who, like, you know, I'm just saying math is a really easy one to imagine this, but there are some people who are maybe brilliant mathematicians who would absolutely suck at teaching math.
I know some people that I would consider to be brilliant that would make a horrible teacher, so yeah.
Yeah, thing is, you can have certain kinds of smarts and then be very bad at teaching, even the kind of smart that you
have.
No,
I agree, totally.
Yeah. So under NCLB, existing teachers, including teachers with tenure, were supposed to meet all kinds of weird standards. They could meet the same requirements set for new teachers or could meet a state-determined high objective uniform state standard of evaluation. H-O-U-S-S-E.
Hase.
Hase. Hase. Hase. Hase. Hase.
Hase. Hase now.
Yeah. There's this really interesting report. It's kind of an after-action report on No Child Left Behind. It's called State and Local Implementation of the No Child Left Behind Act, Volume 8.
Did you have to count the Roman numerals?
No. No. Okay. I just, you know, I included all of it because I thought it was important. This is, but
you,
I mean,
pause right when you.
Obviously, there are at least seven others.
I was like,
these.
She's counting.
No. I was just putting special emphasis on the fact that there That's are great. Eight volumes of this thing. That's
it's,
all.
It's very important.
So there are a lot of volumes of this because people have a lot to say about NCLB. But here are some interesting takeaways from this report on the impact of No Child Left Behind. In this report, that says that most teachers met their state's requirements to be considered highly qualified under NCLB. According to state reports, 94% of teachers were highly qualified, and this is from 2006-2007, which was about, NCLB was like 2001, I think, right?
Yeah, it was the main law from 2002-2005. Okay, 2001. We'll call it 2001.
Okay, it's like 2001 and 2002-ish in that era.
Wait a second. Is this Ted Kennedy in this photo?
Probably. He was one of the sponsors of it. Oh. Remember?
Is that Boehner? Is that John Boehner?
John Boehner. Yes. Boehner and Kennedy were co-sponsors.
God, I hate this. I'm sorry.
Are you going to be okay? You seem
I just got mad. I saw John Boehner's face.
John Boehner.
I refuse to believe his name is actually Boehner. He just couldn't be a politician with a last name. I almost just said he couldn't be a politician with a boner, but that's all of them, literally. So. He couldn't be a politician with the last name of Boehner. It's like Anthony Weiner. Look what happened to him.
Maybe it's Boehner.
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 He got more annoying.
Boehner.
It's John Boehner.
Boehner. Beaner.
Beaner.
Booner.
John Beaner.
John. His real.
Bonaire.
Bonaire.
It has to be that.
Jean Bonaire.
Jean Bonnet.
No.
Oh.
Okay. Anyway.
Wrong podcast.
We are not a true crime podcast.
Stay sexy.
Don't get bonered.
Oh, crying. Okay. Where were we?
Okay, so this report found that most teachers met their state's requirements to be considered highly qualified under NCLB. According to state reports, 94% of teachers were highly qualified in 2006 and 2007. So that's about 4 or 5 years after NCLB rolled out. However, state policies concerning highly qualified teachers varied greatly, both in the passing scores that new teachers must meet to demonstrate content knowledge on assessments and in the extent to which state's high objective uniform state standard of evaluation policies give existing teachers credit for years of prior teaching experience. And then next, the percentage of teachers who are not highly qualified under NCLB was higher for special ed teachers and middle school teachers, as well as for teachers in high poverty and high minority schools, which was the whole problem we were trying to solve to begin with, so we didn't. Moreover, even among teachers who were considered highly qualified, teachers in high poverty schools had less experience and were less likely to have a degree in the subject they taught than teachers in more affluent schools. Mm-hmm. Despite NCLB's emphasis on sustained, intensive, classroom-focused professional development, a relatively small portion of teachers reported taking part in content-focused professional development related to teaching, reading, or mathematics for an extended period of time. For example, only 13% of elementary school teachers participated for more than 24 hours in professional development focused on the in-depth study of topics in reading, and only 6% received more than 24 hours of professional development on the in-depth study of topics in mathematics. As we've seen more longitudinal studies on the impact of NCLB, the impact is basically there was none. There was this weird little spike that happened immediately after the rollout of NCLB and then Common Core, and there are just little fluctuations in overall performance numbers, but it all leveled out over time, and the impact of NCLB was basically nil. Like, it was just, it's failed legislation. And then so here comes ESSA, E-S-S-A, Every Student Succeeds Act. It's the successor to NCLB because we have to reauthorize this education bill every so often. So ESSA, ESSA is the successor. It's Obama's educational policy overhaul passed in December of 2015. This new take on the whole problem, it eliminated proficiency and adequate yearly progress requirements, and it also prohibits the Secretary of Education from prescribing any aspect of the accountability system, including teacher evaluation systems or defining teacher effectiveness. Turns it all back over to state control. So
maybe that wasn't a bad move.
Yeah, I don't really...
Maybe Betsy shouldn't have gotten a say.
Maybe we were just safeguarding against the next guy who was in charge, the next lady who was in charge of the Department of Education. So it required... ESSA required states to develop their own goals, long-term, short-term, and interim, and to look at a broad range of factors to gauge school performance, not just test scores. That was a really big part of ESSA, was... defocusing test scores, because NCLB was basically just like, your entire life depends on standardized test scores, because that was the measure of teacher performance. That's how adequate yearly progress was determined or not, was from standardized test scores. So here we are now in this mess of once again decentralized state by state attempts to measure teacher effectiveness and to evaluate teachers.
Yeah, this is where it's all bad.
Right. So now I want to dive into your kind of specialty here, and that's talking about the, just as an example,
being average, according to my value added. Thank you. I'm loving being on this podcast. Thank you for having me.
We're going to talk about Ohio's. We're going to talk about Ohio's teacher evaluation systems, and then your just, you know, your local school's teacher evaluation system, to give some context to the fact that everything we're talking about here, none of it would apply necessarily to any other state in the union. So we're back more or less to a point of not being hugely capable of standardizing the educational experience of students across the country.
Yeah, it's still not doing that. And I don't think these evaluations are going to do that either. Teacher evaluations.
Yeah. Why don't you talk about Ohio's system?
Ohio's evaluation system is called, we all call it ETPES. It's the teacher and principal evaluation system. So I'm going to call it ETPES because that's what it is to me. I student taught in the fall of 2012, and the school that I was student teaching at was kind of pioneering it as one of the schools in Ohio. So it was not yet counting towards teachers' ratings or anything like that, but it was in like maybe year one of it, because my first year of teaching then was for, I got a job in the fall of 2013. So my 2013-14 year, I was evaluated using that system.
Well, I would just say, so just to put that in context, this is a system that probably came out of NCLB.
Yes.
So this is an accountability measure.
Yes.
So a lot of states got waivers on all of those measures because it was taking them so long to put these systems place. And this system that you're talking about is that system that came out of
and
NCLB.
And it's still, we're right now going through changing it to 2.0.
Right, to be probably our new version, more compliant with ESSA, right?
So we have OTES.
So how are you even supposed to get anything done when the
right,
everything is just moving around you all the time. You're like, I'm just trying to teach.
It's just like you go up to kick the field goal and it gets moved. You know, it's like Charlie Brown over and over again.
Yes.
So
the lucification effect.
We have OTES, which is the Ohio Teacher, you know, evaluation system, and they call it ETPES, which includes the principal evaluation system. But basically in Ohio, it looks like a few things depending on your career, depending on how long you've been working, depending on your data. It can do a bunch of stuff. So we have basically, you're going to drown if you drink that much water. You're going to go belly up, and I'm going to finish this podcast by myself. So there's a difference between a full evaluation year and a non-full evaluation year. So every year, teachers have to complete the self-assessment summary tool.
Ew.
Let me pass this out to Chelsea for her to gaze upon.
I'm going to consult the handout.
This is my self-assessment.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my professional growth plan.
Okay.
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 So I'm just going to go with you. Okay. Ready? So beginning of every year, teachers have to complete the self-assessment. That is only for us to see the self-assessment. This is where we get to set our own goals. Okay. So we have areas to focus and areas for improvement. And then we identify those each year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
So that's the first thing that happens. Every single year.
This is a lot of paperwork.
Even if you're not in a full evaluation year, you have to fill out the self-assessment tool.
Okay. Okay.
So the teacher self-assessment is a summary tool that we use, but that's only for us. And then we have to create the professional growth plan. And the growth plan is where we choose two areas to focus on for the school year. That's the other paper you have. The professional growth plan, the PGP as we call it, that we have to have done every year by a date in September. And it does get reviewed by administration so that they know what our goals are.
Mm-hmm.
One extra layer to this is that whenever you get a teaching license in the state of Ohio, you have to have a five-year plan. So your professional growth plan should closely align, or at least roughly align, to what your five-year plan is, because otherwise you haven't been working on the work you're supposed to be doing as part of renewing your five-year license.
Oh my God.
How you doing?
I'm
are you glad you
exhausted
had,
already.
Are you glad you chose this?
Yeah.
That's only two handouts. We're not even there yet. Okay. So okay.
Please continue.
Professional growth plan is for the administrators. You have to do that regardless of your evaluation year. Okay. So again, I didn't give you my five-year plan, but my five-year plan and my professional growth plan most years are close to each other because that's what I'm supposed to be working on as I have to renew my license next summer.
Okay.
Okay. So there.
Okay.
You have to do those two things every year. From that point is when things get a little iffy sometimes. So for reference, I have been teaching, this is my eighth year, as we've said multiple times, because mm-hmm. I've gotten it wrong a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
In volume 8.
Volume 8 of teaching.
Yes, this is truly. I've had 5 full evaluation years out of technically 7 because COVID year doesn't count.
Okay.
So normally once you get your continuing or a 5-year, you're not supposed to be evaluated
continuing
every
contract,
year.
So
continuing contract.
So basically 10-year.
So at
basically.
My school, you can get a continuing after working there 7 years, having a master's, whatever else. There's other requirements, but those are the basics. So I got a continuing last year, but because my school has gone through shifts in administrators, I have bounced around between who was evaluating me. So I have gotten into, unfortunately, stuck in a cycle of full evals because I keep getting moved around and they want to do a full because they're new and we're learning each other's styles, basically. Most teachers, I would say, aren't doing as many full evaluations as I am.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just, unfortunately, how it worked for
me. The timing was weird.
It has been weird timing, yes. So a full evaluation year looks like basically these things. So it normally starts with a pre-conference, and the pre-conference is a series of 1 million questions, and it's where we lay out like our plan for the lesson that is we're going to be teaching in front of the administrator who's evaluating us.
So this one is a planned evaluate, like,
so this,
at least one of these, it's not
formal
surprise.
Evaluations are planned, informal or not.
So that's that informal is when they can just pop into your room and be like, hey, what's up?
Informals are drive-bys. Yep. They're
okay,
drop-ins.
I find that practice rude.
So
it's rude.
Formals, I've had administrators tell me I get to pick a date. It just needs to be in the next 2 weeks. And I've been told I have 3 dates to choose from and I pick one. So it's up to the administrator, sort of, and you to work out what it's going to be. So this would be a formal evaluation. So you fill out all the pre-conference questions and you submit those ahead of time so that the evaluator has a chance to look over them. So before they do the formal, they usually do an informal, which is a drop-in.
Yes.
Okay. So normally that happens between the time it's scheduled, when you do your pre-conference, and when they show up to actually watch the lesson.
Okay.
Because they want to see the learning leading up to it.
Okay.
Okay. So then you have your formal, which is what you've agreed upon together, and you've answered all the questions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Pre-conference is just like pages and pages and pages of paperwork
so
that she's handing me, by the way.
Your pre-conference, I've had administrators do it both ways. I've had to meet in person and go over it with them, and I've had them just email me with questions. So you have your formal, following an informal and your pre-conference. And then after the formal, you have a post-conference. And so the Ohio ETPES system,
OTES
system.
This is like a whole thing.
Yeah.
This is a whole thing.
I'm not done yet.
Okay.
We're not even close
to
there.
I'm very sorry.
So then you have a post-conference and you meet with them and you talk about what they wrote down about you, what they saw, all of this stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so the post-conference is a chance where you can provide support for something that maybe you didn't score as well and that you believe you have the support to score, you know, whatever, better on. So you can provide more evidence to to help support yourself and saying, oh, I did have this. You just didn't see it because of whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So then you get rated on that. Sometimes in a formal cycle, because you do two formals in a year if you're in a full evaluation,
mm-hmm.
they'll do another informal like a week after it just to see what happened. Like in class, like where did I go with it? Just depends on how much time the evaluators have. So that's one cycle.
Okay.
So if you're in a full, you do it a whole nother time later in the year. Usually they do it like fall, like October, November at my school. And then again, like February, March, which is really hard February because we typically have quite a few snow days. So you repeat for the second cycle. Sometimes you might only have one informal. Maybe you'll have both if it's necessary. And then another option for teachers is a teacher professional project, which I've never done, but it is an option as far as earning towards your total summative score.
Okay.
So at the end of the year, whenever you've completed what your cycle looks like to you, you meet with your evaluator and you're given proficiency on standards performance scores, which is on a scale of ineffective, developing, skilled, or accomplished. So that's how they grade you on the formal evaluations. So that's one data point.
So they're like, there are four options again. Ineffective, what is it?
Ineffective, developing, skilled, or accomplished.
Okay.
That's on one section of the score.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, this is my formal. Carry on. Okay. So they take that rating, which is 50% of my total, and add it to what I get on the student growth measures, which is based on my value added, which I also brought for you from 2 years ago.
Wow.
Enjoy. And so then they average it to get my final summative rating, which works on the same scale as the one I mentioned earlier, which is ineffective, developing, skilled, or accomplished. And so here's an example of my final summative rating. This is from 2016-2017.
Wow.
Yes. So once you get that final summative, that's like usually in May that meeting happens because in the state of Ohio, you have to have them filed by a specific day in May so that it's not like the end of the year and you're being evaluated then because that would be pretty unfair.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the year, you meet one-on-one with your evaluator. You go through all of your data. You go through everything you have, basically all of your evaluations, if you were scored accomplished or skilled or whatever. And they give you a list of areas of reinforcement and areas of refinement that you're supposed to focus on for the next year. So if you were to look at my areas of reinforcement and refinement, you would see that I use those sometimes on my beginning of the year plans because I know I'm supposed to be carrying them over. If you score ineffective in Ohio, you get put on an improvement plan, but I believe those can also be applied to those who score developing. It just depends on your test data if you're a tested subject. So improvement plans are in addition to your cycle and are more work than what you are already doing. And it's basically a hand-holding measure that they use for teachers who have...
It's so that they can say, look, we're doing something more about this problem.
Yes. And it's horrible because the best teacher that I know at our district has had to be on an improvement plan multiple times since I've been there. And it's because of the student population that they teach. And so that translates then to normally not great data, which then automatically puts them at a level where they have to do an improvement plan. Yep. So the problem
is... You can be on an improvement plan, the long story short there, because of just...
Bad data.
The slice of students that you happen to teach. If this same teacher taught a different slice of students, they probably would never be on an improvement plan.
So that's one of the biggest problems with this system, among other things, is that it is not able to consider the population of students and what that data looks like. So over time, what they've done is we've had student learning objectives, which were SLO tests, that we used in cahoots with our other data as a way to try to offset those numbers, because the idea was that you would write an SLO for your class based on what you knew you would cover, and hopefully between the pre and post tests, they would score at a high enough level that could help offset your test data, which would normally be lower for some people.
Mm-hmm.
We got rid of SLOs this year as part of a new process, so that isn't going to be able to help people anymore. All of these handouts are to say that the system is broken and that it's a lot of paperwork, and it is very frustrating to feel like I spend all of this time to only have, 30 pages of paper to hand to you to define one whole year of my career. Like, it's just very frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a tested subject. So each year I have to use my value added, which is my testing data, combine that with my data from my SLO when we had SLO. So this year it'll just be my value added plus whatever I score in my evaluations. That will create my total rating, and mm-hmm. that'll be what I'm held to next year.
Mm-hmm.
So we do this every single year. What has been interesting as part of this, though, is that COVID has really thrown some of this directly in the air.
Uh-huh.
And it has really, I think more than anything, it's made us realize, like, oh, you mean this really wasn't that important, was it? And now guess what? We made it a year without it, and we all survived because we didn't complete cycles last year.
Mm-hmm.
So evaluations weren't completed, like I said, or scored last year, partially because it couldn't be finished. But I do know people who got evaluated virtually, which would have been horrible in April of last year.
Yeah.
But also because there's no testing data for the other portion of the evaluations. So our data includes state testing as well as SLOs, like I mentioned before, and other local data that is used in evaluating teachers. So that information will look different at every single school in the state because they all decided locally what they did.
Here's the other thing.
Except for that, there were no end of course exams, which was true for the whole state.
Yeah. The other thing, though, is that it can look different even from school to school within a district. You know,
yes.
It's like... So we've got the State Department of Education that's dictating the way that the state is going to adhere to the mandates of a 20-year-old piece of educational legislation.
Our buildings in my small district are doing this differently.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where I'm getting there. So we've got, like, NTLB says you have to do this. So that trickled down into an attempt to evaluate teachers, which is all of this paperwork that you just talked about. That trickles down to school districts.
Yes.
Who, district to district, they will all deal with interpreting the state standards for evaluation differently. And then even within a district, building to building, or even administrator to administrator, things can be interpreted differently and are interpreted differently. One of the problems with stuff like this is that when you, for example, get a new principal or something, that principal might have an entirely different rubric in their head. I mean, they're supposed to have a rubric that they evaluate on, but they have entirely different interpretations of the standards in their head, which results in, from year to year, either, you know, an insane change in one direction or another in your teacher evaluations just because you got a new administrator. That kind of stuff happens. So it's just like...
I've had three new administrators evaluate me in 8 years, not including the principal I had when I was student teaching, who evaluated me just to teach me, basically, as a student teacher. And they have all interpreted the rubric differently.
Yeah.
As far as what they viewed as skilled or accomplished or whatever. So, and I don't put that on them. I put that on the system that's created this rubric, right? Like, I don't think that if you and I read it, we would come to the same conclusions. So I don't see a problem in those types of things, but it is frustrating, you know what I mean, to be like, oh, well, this administrator took this as support for student learning when this one didn't value it as much. Like, those are the types of things that can happen.
Yeah, because everybody has their pet thing that they went to some educational conference and saw some talk, and they want you to do that thing exactly the way they think, which is fine to be interested in different pedagogical methods, and it's fine to have ideas about that stuff, but when you use your idea as a sledgehammer to smack all of your teachers down about how you think they should best be teaching, the whole idea of having standards at all is to try to counteract some of that bias that can come from individual, and just, you know, just the nature of individuals being individuals. But in practice, it just doesn't work. And, like, most of the data from these things is essentially meaningless, because what happens is most teachers get evaluated at being effective. And so the whole point of all of this was to try to kind of understand.
I don't even know if I'd say most do.
They really do. Statistically speaking, most evaluators will evaluate their own teachers well, even if they're not great. Is the thing. Basically, what came out of NTLB was just like, well, everybody's giving everybody a high rating, so what's the point of ratings that happen?
I find that interesting.
Yeah.
Because I know of districts and know of people who have experienced this, not them personally, I suppose I should say, but who have used this data from OTAs as a way to release teachers.
Yeah, it does happen.
So I think...
It absolutely does happen. And I mean, this is kind of like it's related to what we were talking about before, about this was kind of ESSA related, but that version of the education bill basically made it so that you had to identify a certain portion of your teaching population as underperforming. So when we got those, that and that happened because after NCLB, everyone's like, fine, we'll do the ratings. And everybody came out fine from the ratings. So it's like, okay, well, your ratings are broken. Okay. Now you have to pick on lower performing teachers. So that's another consequence. It's just another consequence of the evolution of that law, basically. But yeah.
I'm having a hard time with that because there are teachers who score pretty well on their evaluations, and it's still not enough to get them effective on the rubric because their testing data isn't good enough.
Mm-hmm.
So they're, I don't think it's averaging out that way for some.
Well, I think the data that I was looking at on that point was specifically about like observational evaluation data. So not testing data. This was about...
Right, I guess I was saying... Yeah, okay, I understand. So you're saying one that part in a formal evaluation, as far as going to their classroom, they would probably be rated effective. But maybe not their summative total would be effective because of data being
maybe
a factor.
Yeah,
I got you. No, I was just trying to understand what you meant.
Yeah.
So essentially that point that you made was just about in-person evaluations. Yeah,
the whole point of it was that...
I understand.
The people who are in charge of evaluating are not good evaluators because the data comes out meaningless if everybody has more or less the same rating. You know, there are obviously going to be people who don't always get high ratings, but it's anyway.
It's hard to get a high rating.
Yeah. But the thing is just like everyone is considered a highly effective teacher at the end of the first round of NCLB. So this whole, like the whole system, or at least kind of like the 1.0 version of the whole system, resulted in stuff that was not useful at all on a grand scale.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what 2.0 looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, well, yeah. So, I mean.
Can I say one thing that I think is going to be very interesting?
Sure.
Just as someone, I love data. You know, I love data.
Mm-hmm.
I am interested in seeing the effects of no EOCs.
No what?
End of course exams, which is the state-required testing that happens to earn graduation points in high schools.
Standardized tests. It's just an acronym for standardized tests that teachers use.
I'm trying to sell it as a little bit more than that. No, you're right. It's our current standardized test to graduate high school.
Great. Yeah.
It's our new OGT. So
Ohio graduation test.
I'm interested to see because... normally a student scores between a 1 and a 5 because they have to earn so many points towards graduation. Mm-hmm. And I'm very interested because last year when there were no EOCs, what they did with those students who were supposed to be tested was they gave them the equivalent of their final grade as a test score. Mm-hmm. So if a student got an A in my college prep English 10 class, they got a 5 on this test, basically towards graduation. And I'm so fascinated to hear what that does for teacher data. Because I'm curious how that will reflect on us, if it does, after the next year, this year, when we're about to test, to see what kind of data they're sending back to us. And I'm also really fascinated to see if that will at all change the graduation numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Because those tests are obviously one of the biggest things that force or, you know, as our students choose to drop out. So I'm just really curious to see what this data does as far as other trends that it could, you know, implicate schools in their yearly report cards and also teachers and their data. I'm just really curious about that. And I think it'll be interesting to see the next few years come out.
Yeah, these yearly report cards you're talking about are another
thing. We'll do another episode on that.
Yeah, it just is another part of, well, in the end, NCLB, No Child Left Behind. It's things that school districts have to publish about their own performance numbers year after year. They have to publish these reports to stakeholders and, you know, and also to the state departments of education.
Graduation, that percentage is a huge factor.
Graduation rate really highly impacts your score on your district report card.
So I'm just really curious to see if doing that for this group of students, because we're talking about last year's 10th and 11th graders, so this year's junior seniors. I'm just really curious to see what it looks like as far as data for that and what that will look like in teacher terms as well in a few years, because I'm curious about the curves. So It'll be a fascinating part of this.
It sure will. The kind of lasting effects of COVID. It'll be curious to see where the trends go.
Yeah.
All of this stuff. Yep.
Huh. Interesting.
Huh. All right. Well,
in conclusion, evaluations suck.
Yeah. Yeah. I listening to you deal with all of the paperwork around it and all of the stress around it, I just, the level of scrutiny that is focused on teachers compared to the level of scrutiny that's focused on any other professional is just wild. It's out of control.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of paperwork, the amount of reporting and evaluating, it's all out of control. I would feel absolutely stifled by this evaluation cycle if I had to do this in my job.
Yeah.
So people who think that educators have it easy or something are just very misinformed about the realities of being evaluated, because your job depends on this data, your salary depends on these data, everything hinges on this, and it all is kind of a crapshoot, because not only do interpretations of rubrics and standards vary from building to building or admin to admin or state to state, you also can deal with environmental factors in the classroom that are completely out of your control. So your kids just get back from Christmas break or are just leaving for Christmas break. Probably just leaving for Christmas break would be the true frenzy, I would guess. But like, it's the last day of school before a long break. Kids are losing their minds, basically. They're bouncing off the walls. If an admin is like, "Yo, this works for my schedule, is a good day to have a teacher evaluation," that's going to be a wildly different classroom experience from what your normal day-to-day classroom experience is going to be, and that has nothing to do with your value or your skill as an educator.
Yeah, it is really limiting, I will say, because there have definitely been times where the day that I was told it was going to be, if that worked or whatever, I was like, I'm giving a test that day and I'm going to pass it out and observe them and see if they have questions.
Yeah.
So we're not really going to check off the boxes of like differentiated instruction or student-led learning.
They're taking a test. All the things that it
wants me to do. So like, it is really limiting, because I think the hope of it is to say any day you can come in and this can happen.
Yeah.
But in reality, teachers want to make sure that the day that they're, you know, because like every day looks different.
Right.
But there are definitely days that I'm like, oh, this is great. Project-based learning or something like that. Like, so I try to pick the times where they can see those like collaborative whatever more than I want them to like come in. And I've had walkthroughs done when they're taking a quiz and it's like not great, but it's like, well, this is what we're doing. I'm not going to change it.
Yeah.
And like I use Membeam, like I've talked about before, which we do 3 times a week for 15 minutes and it's individualized online vocabulary training.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes my walkthrough is just them looking at them doing Membeam.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's differentiated.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like it looks like I'm just sitting at my computer, but yeah. I'm, you know, so. But those are the hard things that aren't taken into account on a rubric like that.
Right.
Is that learning looks like a million things, and it's not just the days that we do.
Yep.
Gallery hops around the room or something like that.
The other thing that kind of bothers me about it, and maybe you can speak to this a little bit, but how is professional development, not that you have much of an opportunity for that because districts don't pay for you. You have to pay for your own professional development. You have to pay for your own recertification. You have to pay for, you know, you're basically in a lot of cases paying out of pocket if you want to go to a conference or if you want to learn anything, you're doing it on your dime. It's also a requirement that you do a certain amount of professional development every year. So like, does professional development, you doing it, have any bearing on these evaluation cycles? No. Which is really upsetting, right?
I mean, we get professional development on how it works. We get, like, right now we're going through 2.0, like, the new evaluation system, so...
I just mean that the whole thing is, like, you have to tell them, okay, I did the amount of hours I'm supposed to do. They're not looking at the quality of the professional development that you're able to pursue, because it costs money to do professional development.
What are you saying?
I'm saying they're not, like... Professional development should be a big part of a teacher evaluation cycle. You deciding to become better at your job by learning
new
things.
We do have to include on one of the forms what relevant professional development we've done.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't scored specifically.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
We do have to include it.
I guess my point is, it seems to me like a teacher deciding to improve themselves through professional development should feature more prominently on things like scoring.
Yeah, I mean, they just expect us to do that because we have to have it for our license.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And all they're doing really on the PD front is counting hours. That's really all they're doing. And there's a huge opportunity there if districts would bother to try to help educators become better educators by funding professional development opportunities. There's just all kinds of stuff in this conversation that I think we're getting wrong. It's just a huge bureaucratic nightmare, basically, right now. And
I mean, occasionally they'll email us and be like, you can do this for free if you want, because it's like we have a special grant or we have leftover money or whatever. But like, I've been at schools before where every teacher got X amount of dollars every year to use towards professional development. Nice.
So. But that's not your
current
situation.
A lot of that also ran out when Race to the Top went away.
Yeah.
So there are, you know, those are other things that are factors. And also because when you teach in a...
Race to the Top was a prize that was given, basically a prize for implementing NTLB and Common Core standards. It's just like, it's a funding initiative to reward school districts that supposedly excel.
Yeah, I would be surprised if they start considering professional development as part of the scoring, just because we're required to do it. And like, for us to get our professional development, we have to have it pre-approved before we go and do it. Like, they're checking off the boxes to make sure it's relevant to what we do anyways. So I would be surprised if they start doing that. I wouldn't hate it.
Yeah, my point there is that if we care about actually making teachers better, we really should be caring a lot more about professional development.
Yeah.
And we should be reflecting that care.
Let's be careful about how much professional development we do here, though.
Well, no, but
we
I
get
mean,
stuck in a lot of crap meetings.
That's what I'm saying, is that the quality
I'm just joking.
Well, I was also trying to say the quality of professional development should be something that should be considered. If you're sitting in a bullshit meeting with an administrator who is not well equipped to do professional development, that shouldn't really, you know, that's not a quality professional development opportunity. It's just not. But that is, you know, teachers are expected to sit through meetings that is kind of just like, they boil down to like, here's teaching 101 that's run by your whatever district, you know, person or building administrator or something like that.
Sometimes the educational service center comes in.
Yeah. It's just, they're having been on the periphery of some of these things, I have a lot of friends who are teachers, and I just hear about this kind of stuff all the time. And what passes for professional development is truly a joke. So, you know, and then that kind of is passed along into the teacher evaluation system. It's just like everybody treats PD as more or less a joke. And PD is a huge opportunity for teachers to actually become better teachers. And it's all just kind of like either just somebody filling in the check marks that they have to fill in, counting hours and handing out crappy attempts at pedagogical instruction. It's just a whole big thing, and it's a mess, and I can't say anything other than it's just a huge waste of time, really. All of it. This is not to say that like we shouldn't evaluate teachers, not at all. Like we absolutely should have some accountability in the system, but like the way that we are doing it now is so monumentally broken that I don't even know where to start. That's my final thought on the whole thing.
I respect it.
Yeah. Are we ready to move on to fill in the blank?
I'm very ready
to leave this behind for forever.
I would like to leave it behind though.
Okay. You want to do last week's question?
Sure.
Last episode's question, I mean?
So last episode's question was about St. Patrick's Day. It says that it's thought that the shift to green happened because of Ireland's nickname as the Emerald Isle. The green in the Irish flag and the shamrock are clover. Green ribbons and shamrocks were worn as early as the 17th century. Wearing green has become a staple of St. Patrick's Day, but the holiday was originally associated with what color? And it was blue.
Blue?
Blue.
Blue St. Patrick's Day?
That's what it says.
I can't imagine having blue beer on St. Patrick's Day. That's not as fun.
Oh, I could do that if that's what was required of me.
You'll drink beer of any color?
I haven't said no yet.
All right.
I mean, try me, I guess.
Yeah.
Run it by me and I'll let you know if I refuse it.
This episode's question. Congress approved the creation of a U.S. Department of Education as its own cabinet-level agency in 1979. When President Jimmy Carter made his selection for the nation's first Secretary of Education, he picked this woman at the time, a serving federal appeals court judge and former California Court of Appeals judge who did not have a background in education policy.
Oh my gosh, Betsy DeVos's mom.
It's just like the very first one we picked.
Oh, Jimmy.
No background in education for you, sorry. Her time as secretary was short. Although she was sworn in by Carter in December of 79, the educational department only began operations in May of 1980, and she left in early 81 when President Ronald Reagan took office. What was her name? The very first secretary of education, what was her name? And why was she a judge? Why? That's not the question, but Why wasn't she an education professional? Why wasn't she a teacher?
Jimmy,
why?
You're supposed to be better than Liz.
Jimmy.
I can't believe we made it this to 1979 without one. Like, that's kind of upsetting.
Yeah, it actually kind of surprised me that it's only been around that long. When I looked that up, I was like, oh, wow. It's a relatively new cabinet level position.
Yeah, that's like in the grand scheme, basically.
Yeah.
Probably one of the youngest.
Could be, I'm not sure. Like, Homeland Security's.
That's true.
More recent. So.
That's true.
Yikes.
Okay, fair.
All right. So what did you learn this week?
Well, like everyone in the world, I couldn't get off of Twitter because of the great boat reckoning of the Suez Canal.
The great boat reckoning. The great boat squishing into the side.
The turny-wurny of the Suez. The boat in the Suez. I remember being taught, right, who knows what grade that was, sixth grade probably, where everyone was like, the Suez Canal, and I had to write like an extended response on a test that was like, why is it
about
important?
The Suez Canal?
Yeah, like, okay. Whatever. I've not thought about the Suez Canal since then. I didn't think we relied as heavily on it as we do. I don't know where
that
I thought things came from.
One ship can grind the world economy to the halt.
Well, I think I read somewhere that one ship, it was like, costing the economy $400 million an hour.
Yeah.
For it being stuck there.
Because of all the other ships that got stuck. Yes.
And so then I was reading on Twitter, they were like, there are ships out there that had animals on them. And like, what if they ran out of food and water?
Yeah, people
and
are like, this could become a humanitarian crisis, right, if we don't get this thing unstuck
and
really
like,
soon.
And I've read so much about it, it's like overwhelming, but they're basically like, oh, if you go this way, there are pirates, which is an issue, right? Like,
yes, around the southern tip of,
right,
Africa.
So like, that's a problem.
Uh-huh.
And then another thing that I read was talking about how there are guides to get you through it.
Yes.
And how it's kind of like a
local authorities that you have to bribe to get through the Suez Canal.
Right.
Yes.
And so this one guy was a TikTok, but he was basically saying like he anticipated that captain will probably be arrested for this. And, yeah, like, wondering if it was whatever. So what I learned is that the Suez Canal is very important. And
yes,
that maybe it should be a little bit deeper.
Wider, I think.
And a little bit
issue.
Wider.
Yeah, a little wider.
And maybe when it does happen again, we don't just bring in one backhoe at a time.
A little backhoe. Digging out this massive
and also,
floating
there were
city.
A bunch of people on boat Twitter who were like, it's going to fall over. And I'd never considered that either. And apparently that could have been a thing as well.
Yeah, it could tip
so,
the wrong way.
I don't know. Maybe we need to work this out. As like mostly developing countries in the world, maybe we can find a better route or fix this one,
mm-hmm,
and not make it so messy.
It's very precarious, the Suez Canal.
Well, and when you throw in the politics of it,
yes,
I had no idea there were like, you like paid these dudes in like cartons of cigarettes, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you're telling me the world's economies.
Bodie McBoatface got to bribe his way through.
Like, I just can't believe that it boils down to, like, maybe he had a bad guide.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get enough cigarettes, so he was like, well,
yeah,
just make a left here.
Yep.
Goodbye. He takes off on his jet ski. That's what I imagine.
Bye.
Anyways.
Yeah.
I learned about the Suez Canal, because I haven't thought about the Suez Canal in probably 20 years.
Yep.
I mean, how
and
do you top
there
it?
You have
and
it.
There, the more you know.
Mine's really boring compared to that. I learned how to make chimichangas, and they were really good.
Good.
We used your mom's recipe.
We did.
It was delicious.
She makes great chimichangas.
I
don't want to
go eat one now, except we're going to go eat burgers now. But I could eat a chimichanga every day.
I could eat one. I had one for lunch. It was great.
They're really good.
Big fan.
Yeah. It was a multi-step process. There's like rice and there's chicken and you got to do everything individually and then you got to put it all together. And then you got to bake it again.
And you roll
bake
a bee
it,
in it.
Bake it and then you
bake it,
do, take
you
it out
it,
and you bake it again. And
roll it in a bee. Put it in the oven. My chimmy's in me.
Did you just make that up?
Well, it's that one nursery rhyme.
Is it?
Yeah. Do you not know what I'm talking about?
Nope, I have no clue.
What's it called? Roll it and pat it and bake it and put it in the oven for it. And my mom always used to say, Katie and me.
Oh.
Apparently we weren't all so well versed in our baby bakeries.
I know what you're talking about now.
What is it called?
I don't know.
Not Little Miss Muffet. Well, anyways, thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for tuning in to our rager of an episode.
The next time you hear from us, Chelsea will be fully vaccinated.
I will be.
And we're going to be licking all the doorknobs.
Licking doorknobs. Here we come.
See you later.
See you next time.
Bye.
Listeners, thanks for supporting 16 to 1.
We're trying to grow our audience, so please check us out at 16to1.com, all spelled out, and tell your friends about the show.
On our website, you can find links to follow us on social media, an archive of all our old episodes, and a contact form where you can get in touch.
Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next show. Is this over yet?